unlock a door to imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sight. A dimension of sound. A dimension of mind. You're moving through a land of both shadow and substance of things and ideas. Guiding you through this wondrous journey is the hypnotic sound of the Twilight Zone.
It never ends. Twilight Zone stuff keeps spinning and spinning and spinning. Hey, fade away, baby. There we go. I think it's Friday. I believe me, I have no clue what day it is anymore. My schedule's been insane all day. Finally, 2 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago. I'm going to lay down for a while. The hell with this. I came across a headline last night. I don't know where I found it. But just before coming on the air, I decided to do a little bit of research. And let's just say that the headline and the paragraph of the article that I read are a little out of date. It talked about Oregon. And, of course, the headline that was written back in January made reference to a COVID-19 relief fund, this is in the state of Oregon, was only for black residents. $62 million to explicitly benefit black individuals and business owners. And then the lawsuits begin. Well, this is now, 2 months later? 2+ months later. And, a couple of months, almost 3 months. And the story gets twisted a little bit. But who knows? But, I went on, did a little bit of research online, and I'm finding nothing of an updated, more modern commentary. But it doesn't surprise me. As one continues to follow this insanity that we are facing in this nation, I find mine more and more things like this. A couple of days ago, I came across an article that instantly drew me in. Story about a rather tony Midwestern college town with an abundance of white guilt is now leading the way toward reparations for slavery. Well, this particular story struck me personally because when I was first married, or even before I was married, I lived in a one-bedroom, third-story apartment in Rogers Park, Illinois, which is about as far north as the city of Chicago extends. And about a half a block down the street is a cemetery. And I could drive around that cemetery and bingo. I'd be in Evanston, Illinois. Of course, I moved into this marvelous apartment, which, by the way, I did have a view of the beach, Lake Michigan, between two other buildings, which had a parking lot in between the two of them. But it was nice. I'd go down there to weekends during the summers and enjoy time and the cold, nasty, icky water, et cetera, et cetera, with the Hare Krishnas out there giving free veggie food, trying to suck you into their little game. Oh, they completely had taken over a massive apartment complex that also overlooked the beaches, etc. But just past this cemetery, I entered this community, which I now refer to as one of the most idiotic cities in America. And they've chosen to enact reparations. Evanston, Illinois. Hell. Reparations. The American taxpayer has been footing that bill for a very long time, my friends. But it was only a matter of time. As repulsive as the idea of reparations sounds, we knew that someday some leftist college town, somewhere, whether in Ann Arbor, Michigan, or Cambridge, or Madison, Wisconsin, or Berkeley, would sign on to atone for America's original sin. Oh, never mind, it's a sin that no living America was either guilty or subject to. But the idea itself, as author David Horowitz put it in his 2002 book entitled Uncivil Wars, The Controversy Over Reparations for Slavery, is both morally questionable and racially incendiary. And the 10-point case that he made against reparations nearly two decades ago, oh, it has aged remarkably well. But since when did bulletproof logic ever stop a gaggle of do-gooding leftists? And so, my friends, the Chicago suburb of Evanston, Illinois, as CBS News reports, is about to become the first U.S. city to make reparation money available to black residents. Part of a growing movement that has picked up speed in the wake of the police killings of black Americans, including George Floyd last year. George Floyd, to the best of my knowledge, had never even traveled to Chicago, let alone its Tony suburb. Oh, this decision by Evanston officials could also lay the groundwork for other municipalities and states considering reparations. Now, Evanston is a rather Tony and scenic community situated on the shore of Lake Michigan, 30 minutes north of Chicago. Well, when we say that, we're talking about the loop. You know, Chicago proper, down to the city, man. You know, you catch my drift. Well, in Evanston, the city's black population is about 16%. In addition to being the nation's reparations trailblazer, Evanston is home to Northwestern University. Oh, where I used to go to the football games when I went to boys camp in the summer. Bucky's Boys Club. Northwestern University also has such marvelous professorial people like, what was the guy's name that was bombing stuff during the Vietnam War? And, he's a big hotshot professor up there now. Can't think of his name. But Northwestern University boasts the lowest acceptance rate and highest annual tuition rate costs in the big conference. Acceptance of blacks, that would be. Now, we suspect that Evanston is also home to one of the white guiltiest city councils in America, a council that CBS reports voted 8-1 the other evening to start with an expenditure of $400,000. To give 16 eligible black households $25,000 each to be spent on home repairs or down payments on property. Well, who pays for this? Oh, well, you know, they're funding this by a new tax on legalized marijuana. The city previously had committed $10 million over 10 years to repairing the ongoing harm that systemic racism has caused Evanston's black residents, with the housing initiative its first step. The first step? Well, maybe it's just a down payment. That would make sense, given that 25 grand is chump change compared to the reparations tab calculated last year by three college professors of $6.2 quadrillion. Going to 16% of the population? 16.2 quadrillion. That's 6 and a 2 followed by 14 zeros. Or to put it another way, that drives home the fiscal enormity of that number. If we were to divide $6.2 quadrillion by $1 bills into 16 even stacks, each of those stacks would reach the moon, Alice, the moon. Well, I guess in some respects you could say white folk is getting off pretty cheap, at least so far. But if anything good could be said of the Evanston measure, it's the targeted nature of the giveaway and the specified way in which it could be spent. If you're wondering about all the other black residents of the city, the criteria for inclusion were also pretty specific. As National Review reported, residents who have either lived in or been a direct descendant of a black person who lived at Evanston between 1919 and 1969, and who suffered discrimination in housing because of city ordinances, policies, or practices, well, they would be eligible to receive funds. Well, that could be kind of interesting. There was a pretty wealthy black families that lived at Evanston back during that time period. That certainly clawed their way up to the upper echelons of politics and business, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder how much their kids are going to suck out of the damn thing. Oh, but that's a story for another day. How do Evanston residents feel about all this? Will they be inclined to take it out on their elected representatives? We'll find out next election cycle. And, oh, by the way, as for the one lone no vote, nah, it didn't come from a principled opponent of reparations. It came from Alderwoman Cicely Fleming, who didn't think the measure went far enough, and instead called it a housing program masquerading as reparations. Where she also saw some progressive paternalism in the handout. True reparations, she said, should respect black people's autonomy and allow them to determine how repair will be managed, including cash payments as an option. They're being denied that in this proposal, she said, which gives money directly to the banks or the contractors on their behalf. Well, you know, our nation's first Aflac president, Barry Satoro, he blamed whites for our nation's failure to enact reparations nationally, but at least he can no longer blame the good white wokesters of Evanston. And perhaps with our nation's most progressive cities leading the way, Obama will one day run out of other people to blame. Now, it's interesting the reference to Obama comes up, because that very educator that I was referencing before also was a good friend of the Obamas. As a matter of fact, owned a piece of property which he, quote, donated to the Obamas so they can have their first Tony home down in one of the better suburbs of Chi-Town, baby. Oh, and also as relates to Evanston, my father, who's been deceased since 68, and my uncle, who just turned 86 weeks ago, back in the day used to run money for the mob to one of the hotel chains in, they call it the numbers racket. Yeah, they were selling numbers tickets, etc. Oh, yeah, this is back in the day, you know. God help us all. My father's got to be rolling in his grave today. I gotta call Uncle Jimmy and talk to him about this thing. He's going to crack up. That is the insanity of this modern world. Good God. Critical race theory. I think about this in terms of the Evanston story, which I published late last night. This constant reference to cancel culture. My comment was we needed to cancel Evanston. But let's talk about You know, everything is cancel culture, critical race theory. It's all a classic commie divide and conquer tactic. And so rather than serve, help heal a nation, critical race theory has proven to be poisonous to liberty, true community, our common humanity. Of all the ways identity politics has been used as a tool to sow hatred among people where there should be the potential for friendship, this thing that's now known as critical race theory is one of the gravest offenders. Every person of goodwill should know that judging people based on their physical characteristics is cruel. It's wrong. And yet, that seems to be the news thing that the whole media's jumped on, man. But that should not be the nature of critical race theory. Rather, the insidious ideology is being used to promote estrangement rather than friendship, hostility rather than goodwill. In other words, keep everybody pissed off at each other. Oh, my friends, indeed, the tactics used by proponents of critical race theory share many parallels with the old tactics used by the Bolsheviks. I maybe shouldn't have tried to use an accent on that word because it comes out sounding something worse and more foul than it really is, which it's foul enough. But because of all of this, federal employees and those who work for corporations that do business with the federal government have sucked into the poisonous vortex of critical race theory. Oh, and they can thank, yes, even President Trump for ordering a stop to the promulgation of critical race theory. Thanks could also be sent to scholar Christopher Rufo, whose diligence brought the critical race theory venom to the forefront of Trump's attention. And one Russ Vaught, director of the Office of Management and Budget back then, who was working to root out members of the administrative state who defied the order. You know, it's important to remember that because very few of its activists have shown much sincere desire to end racism, critical race theory should not be taken entirely at face value. If a majority of its supporters were sincere, they'd be willing to have fruitful discussions in a civil society that supports civil discourse. Rather, critical race theory's agitators are committed to tearing down civil society, all upon the pretense that it is an incubator for systemic racism. It's interesting to throw Trump's name into this, ordering a stop to the promulgation of critical race theory. I'll tell you why. Trump, as little as I liked him for many, many reasons, his braggadocio, his bullshittedness. I can get away with saying that because that's a word that doesn't exist, but I just made it up. And a marvelous relationship with black people, and had for most of his life. You go do the studies on your own. I'm not going to spend time with it today. But let's talk a little bit about this. Because if you've got any doubt about what I've just shared with you, consider the Smithsonian display on whiteness. It condemned all elements of civil society, including politeness, hard work, self-reliance, logic, planning, family cohesion. None of those are white values, but their critical race theory frames them just so. And that sort of animus proves that critical race theory arguments are non-starters. They merely serve as a convenient pretext for power grabs. It's a con job, as it were. They suck everybody into everything for the wrong reason, and it's all discussed incorrectly. But doused with critical race theory, the Black Lives Matter organization and its related Antifa-infused mobs were organized for the same purpose, as all cult recruits to recruit more people and to implement the desire to divide and conquer. By the way, you notice just how quiet Antifa and BLM have been since Joey took over? Or Joey pretended to take over? You get my drift. But these phenomenons could be seen as over this past year they would surround people in vehicles or restaurants, demanding their victims raise a fist and recite slogans under the intense intimidation and implications of violence. Agitators who deployed critical race theory had zero interest in ending racism. Instead, they've made essentially the same point over and over and over again, that racism is an unsolvable problem. Because if you've been tainted as white, you ain't right, Jack. Ain't nothing you can do about it. You are eternally a racist, especially if you don't believe you are. Which, of course, I find hilarious because, I hate to say it, but it seems to me that more people of color are racist than all the people that are white that I've known in my lifetime were racist. There's one, Robin DiAngelo, who explained it in her best-selling book entitled White Fragility. But your only option is the cultist option. Submit to your critical race theory overlords and then recruit others to do the same. If, however, you're a black person who disagrees with all of this, well then, you ain't black, Jack! As with all forms of identity politics and intersectionality, critical race theory stokes divisions between people where few or none have existed before. It's all about relational aggression, predatory alienation. Let me share with you a perfect example of this process, a parallel case from Soviet history. As peasant farmers tended to be overwhelmingly religious, traditional, and family-oriented, the Bolshevik government hated them with a fiery passion. And increasing the acrimony further, the peasants resisted giving up their family-run farms, a roadblock to the Soviet leadership's desire to exercise complete control over the nation's food supply. And so to collectivize agriculture, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin devised a plan to stir up hostilities among the peasants where resentments had never existed before. And as would be the case later with Mao's Red Guard and today's radical statue-toppling, Molotov cocktail-throwing radicals in this country, the Soviets used mobs of youth to do the dirty work. And the Communist Youth League, known as the Komsomol, went into villages to propagandize and incite divisions, turning formerly peaceful neighbors against one another. And in his book, The Whisperers, Private Life in Stalin's Russia, Orlando Figes described the situation. He said the villagers had never heard such propaganda in the past. Many were impressed by the long words used by the leaders of the Komsomol. And at these meetings, the villagers were told that they belonged to three mutually hostile classes, the poor peasants, who were the allies of the proletariat, the middle peasants, who were neutral, and the rich, or the kulak peasants, who were its enemies. And the names of all the peasants in these different classes were listed on a board outside the village school. So the process is eerily similar to the way critical race theory and all identity politics has been applied in America today. We can see the same three divisions, the victims, the oppressors, and those who might save themselves by becoming allies of the victims. But then, of course, you've got to note reference to the Komsomol using impressive long words. Today, our miseducated youth are easily impressed by new terms such as systemic racism, intersectionality, white fragility. And finally, the wokesters identify and condemn those marked as oppressors, doxing and canceling them by name in a written list of names posted in the village. Today, such work is helped along by media and big tech. But the whole idea is to sow chaos where there was peace, or at least progress. It is to disrupt and destroy any sense of community that a person may have. And he continued by saying that these divisions were entirely generated by the Komsomol. The villagers had no previous conception of themselves in terms of social class. They'd always thought of themselves as one peasant family. And they then used those newly established identities to rub resentments raw. In Rules for Radicals, agitator Saul Alinsky described the process when he said that the organizer must first rub raw the resentments of the people of the community, fan the latent hostilities of many of the people to the point of overt expression. An organizer must stir up dissatisfaction and discontent, provide a channel in which people can angrily pour their frustrations. Your function, to agitate to the point of conflict. And so, conjuring up such hostilities, my friends, is also the essence of what Karl Marx was aiming for in his call for class consciousness. But the problem, as he saw it, was that people were busy with life and willing to live and let live. Or to put it in modern terminology, they were insufficiently woke. All power elites likewise see social contentment as an impediment to power. In the same fashion, today's critical race theory agitators call for a form of race consciousness that breeds in themselves the same sort of blind hate. And ironically, they're just like a photographic negative, a mirrored image of the segregationist in Jim Crow days. We've been assaulted with many other forms of consciousness intended to sow hostilities and lawlessness, immigration status, gender identity, sexual identity, and so on and so forth. My friends, were being grossly overwhelmed. But the saddest of all is how critical race theory exploits the tragedy of racial divisions in America. The tragedy is thus reduced to nothing but a vehicle for a power grab by elitists in the circles of academia and media and big tech. And ironically, those power elites are vastly disproportionately white and in it for their own gain. And so rather than serve as a balm for healing, critical race theory has proven to be poisonous to liberty, true community, and our common humanity. Profound. Each and every day, we combat and go through this stuff. You ain't black. You ain't black enough. If you is white, you ain't right. It's the insanity that we're facing. Who's stirring up the people against one another? And for what purpose? It's obvious. Think about things we spoke of the other evening. Some of the massive manipulation that took place during the course of World War II. Con jobs on Roosevelt, and I've got no great love for Roosevelt. I never have had. But stick around, and we'll be back. We're going to go in a whole different direction, baby. You better lock and load. But the Ninth Circuit Court says you don't have a right to do it. Be back.
Here. Maybe in the hereafter.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
It's happening, ladies and gentlemen. We here at RBN are working with Front Sight Firearms Training Institute to bring our audience the best in combat, tactical, and defensive firearms training. Whether you're a private citizen who is new to firearms, or you have a concealed weapon permit, and want a level of training that surpasses what you've received from your local gun range, Front Sight provides priceless education and skills taught by seasoned law enforcement, military, and private citizen instructors to levels that far exceed law enforcement and and military standard. With nearly a million responsible citizens trained from every town, city, and state from across the United States, Front Sight has bolstered the Patriot movement to a whole new level. Contact Dan Sutterfield by phone at 573-762-2356 or 573-465-2356 or shoot him an email at domedan, D-O-M-E-D-A-N, at hotmail.com. This is a limited time opportunity. Don't miss it.
Hey there, are you going to wait till the cows come home to get your new Ease-Off drop-and lift?
What in the world is an Ease-Off drop-and lift?
Our Ease-Off is a new tool to increase production for your meat processing company that will get that whole hog or half a beef on or off your rail with our remote control.
That sounds great, but can I afford it?
Sure, and the Ease-Off installs fast. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue, speed up your line, and increase profits.
Okay, I'm convinced. Where can I get my Ease-Off?
Go to easeoff.com. That's EAZEOFF.com. And hurry, because we're offering free shipping for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932-6419.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen planned to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile oxysilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
This morning, the kids had the morning news show on. Brian Campbell was talking about the fighting in Lebanon. Some senator was squawking about the bad economy. It's gonna get worse, you see. You need a change in policy. There's a local paper rolled up in a rubber band. One more sad story's one more than I can stand. Just once, how I'd like to see the headline say, not much to print today, can't find nothing better to say. Because nobody robbed a liquor store on the lower part of town. Nobody OD'd, nobody burned a single building down. Nobody fired a shot in anger, nobody had to die in vain. Sure could use a little good news today.
Oh my goodness, welcome back. It is amazing to me how you can work with, choose your title, board op, producer. There's a difference. The board op drops in and out when he needs to pop a piece of music in when he needs to. A producer's on the money. My friend Michael, who does 98% of the work on this program, has got a feeling and an ability to draw from a wide range of music that we've got in our catalog at the network, and other pieces that maybe have been used elsewhere. He knows what's there. He pulls a piece that says much in many respects of what we talk about here, or try to speak about. I think he was always my friend. Amongst the things that continue to tick me off is this Second Amendment business. And of course, the Ninth Circuit Court has done what they're good at. They've come out and stated that bear arms is not a right. They've chosen to contradict the Second Amendment and itself in a bizarre anti-gun ruling. Keep this in mind. From the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it states a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Ah, but the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has stated there is no right to carry arms openly in public, nor is any such right within the scope of the Second Amendment. Who are you going to believe? The founders who wrote the Second Amendment are the lying bastards seated in the Ninth Circuit Court. Well, the 7-4 in bonk majority of the Ninth Circuit Court is apparently of the leftist school of thought that insists the Second Amendment is all about militias and not the people. Of course, they forget that militias are made up of people. But you see, in the original understanding of the founders, however, the people are the militia. And so these leftists are plainly wrong. The judges then went on to add that we can find no general right to carry arms into the public square for self-defense. No, they insist that the Second Amendment applies only to the defense of hearth and home. They've reduced the word bear to utter meaningless. Imagine this onerous restriction in light of any other constitutional right. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech in the home, or even of faux constitutional rights like abortion or marriage. You can have an abortion so long as the doctor comes to your home. You can marry a same-sex partner, but it doesn't count once you leave your house. The absurdity is self-evident. And yet that is what passes for leftist logic when it comes to guns. But moreover, the offending judges reach around the Constitution by appealing to a 150-year-old Hawaii law, where they weren't even a state, by the way, which stated that in order to reach their conclusions, notes gun writer Cam Edwards, the judges in the majority decided that laws in place in Hawaii before it ever became a state take precedence over the clear and unambiguous language of the Second Amendment, which declares that the right of the people to both keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. According to the Ninth Circuit Court, those long-standing traditions in Hawaii law matter more than Constitution itself. Which is to say nothing of King Edward I, whom the judges also cite in going all the way back to English law in the Middle Ages. Didn't we fight a war of independence from England in which the first shots were fired over an attempt at gun control? Yes. Yes, we did. Well, this bizarre ruling also flies in the face not only of the Ninth Circuit's own previous jurisprudence, but of Supreme Court's important rulings on Heller and McDonald. Unfortunately, Heller largely focused on confirming that the Second Amendment is an individual right, while McDonald held that the Second Amendment is incorporated against the states. That narrow focus left the questions of bearing arms outside the home a glaring example of the Supreme Court's dereliction on the Second Amendment. But perhaps that'll change now, and the Ninth Circuit has somewhat contradicted itself, as well as two other circuit courts. 3 years ago, the Ninth struck down Hawaii's may-issue gun permit regime. In Young v. Hawaii, Judge Diarmuid O'Scanlan, who dissented in this week's case, wrote that the Second Amendment does not protect the right to carry a firearm in public for self-defense. While the current majority nevertheless pointed to a 2016 ruling in which it, quote, held that individuals do not have a Second Amendment right to carry concealed weapons in public, end quote. And yet that ruling was itself an en banc decision overturning a previous ruling to the contrary. The court, as O'Scanlan put it in his dissent, has decided the Second Amendment does not mean what it says. Sounds like a bunch of Mickey Mouse Meshuggah words to me, huh? Obviously, it may be time for the Supreme Court to provide some clarity on an amendment that is abundantly clear to originalists, but has been long since treated as a second-class right. Nate Jackson, Patriot Post. But let's take this a bit further. Some comments that were left on this comment from Bones, asking a simple question, what about Heller? And then we go to a man who signs himself in as a reader, and he's becoming amazingly active on Federal Observer in the comments section. But I will also share with you that he is one of our major contributors, the Federal Observer, and has been for a very long time, and he will continue to do so once we eventually get this conversion thing done. A reader states that, well, I do not want to hang anybody. I would send some lawmen back to training, say every 2 years, and suspend their judicial credentials if they flunked the rigorous class and formal logic. Well, the Ninth Circuit has a long history of fallacious reasoning. In some cases, it looks as if they were making up their invalid logic in order to derive their preconceived false conditions, he says. One of the driving errors in their invalid reasoning is moralistic fallacy, which is also a typical, atypical, but invalid excuse for legislating from the bench. But this is what's bothering me, and it does him too. More and more of our courts are legislating from the bench, including the Supreme Court. That's not their job. If you're going to continue to do that, then just get rid of the Senate and the House. No, Joey's in office. Oh, God. Our author continues by saying, carrying a firearm in public has to be unprotected by the U.S. Constitution, in particular by Second and Ninth Amendment. That's what they speculate. And therefore, carrying a firearm in public is unprotected by the U.S. Constitution. To see how dangerous for our constitutional rights their illogicality is, consider the following. Today, they falsely conclude that there is no constitutional right to carry a firearm in public. Tomorrow, using the same fallacies, they would falsely conclude that there is no constitutional right to carry a firearm in private. From which they will arrive at another false conclusion that there is no right to carry a firearm anywhere. Which would pretty much nix the Second Amendment and obliterate the Ninth Amendment. Clearly, there are many federal judges who are well qualified, wise, and impartial. The district judge, the Honorable Roger Benitez, is one of them. But there are some that are none of the above. Our reader concludes by saying, I would say, Lord save us from stupid judges. Of course, in this particular posting that I put up there, I posted a photograph of a single individual being hung from a tree. I've titled it, Time to Hang the Judges. As our author has stated, the Second Amendment is my gun permit. Issued 12/15 of 1791. Date never expires. Another comment left by my friend the veteran. He says, I believe the judges never read the Federalist Papers. or we're too stupid to understand what the founders meant when they drafted our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Both are easy to understand by any reasonable person. Then again, does a leftist liberal have any common sense? People never comply with ex facto laws. As I've shared with you in the past, there are times that I find comments left by readers to be as strong, and in some cases even stronger, than the author and their original intent. What is today? Friday. Wednesday night, I shared with you a column entitled Cancel Culture. We have met the enemy, our own government. The response that I've had to that program has been shocking to me. In one case, by a comment left by the same gentleman who I just shared a comment with, veteran. He says, outstanding report. As I've said before, the world's leaders are a ship of fools, proud, boastful, arrogant, greedy. And those leaders from the past are now dead and in hell. The current leaders are following suit. They fail to realize that the day will come when they will stand before the Almighty to be judged. And God will say to them, away from me, I never knew you. It's eternal hell for them. Humanity can be such a sad story. I don't know where our country will wind up, but it's not too late to turn to the only one who can save us. Read 2 Chronicles 7:14, where God says, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their evil ways, then I will hear from heaven and still forgive their sin and will hear their land. Apart from this, humanity has no hope. And in many respects, this brief piece that my friend veteran wrote, we could almost use it to comment on almost every program that we do. The piece was written by Kathleen Marquardt, known advocate for property rights and freedom for decades. Never intended to be an activist, but in so many respects has become a leader, an avid supporter of constitutional rights, promoter of civility, sound science, reason. Has become dedicated to exposing the fallacies of the radical environmental and animal rights movements. Last October, I posted a piece of hers, and I mentioned this the other night, that drew her profound thanks. She couldn't believe it. She, as I mentioned to you the other day, she didn't know who we were. And Tom DeWeese knows me, knows of our site, etc. And she got in contact with me. We're staying in contact quite often now. The piece I published last October was the first of a multi-part series. And it became too intense for me to prepare the post. A lot of internal work that had to be done as far as an editing standpoint and conversions to HTML, etc. I'm going to publish the entire series. I may break it down into chapters. I may publish it as an entire mini book. I might even put it together as in a PDF format so that any one of you can go download it and take it and share it. That's a serious consideration I'm making. And I'll begin to do that hopefully over the course of the weekend. I've already got Chapter 5 in place to work on. But Chapter 5 will not appear on Federal Observer, because it deals with a public education system. It's going to be published on metropolis.cafe. And, of course, as we continue to post the other sections, we will ensure that they'll have links. I think once I publish an entire PDF, I will probably put it in a single format so that all the work will come together. Believe me, my friends, it is well worth putting out there. So unbelievably well researched. And that's something it'll begin to work on. Like I say, over the weekend, my weekend is filled up to the point I don't like it. Our heating and AC unit is crapped out. Thank God I've been able to reach my nephew. He's going to come up tomorrow. Send him a bunch of photographs. He's got a couple ideas what he may be able to do to prolong the life of this sucker. And that's fine. I don't feel like forking out money for a new AC unit right now. Got other things I need to do, other things I need to concentrate on. So we shall do these things. I think for possibly a couple of weeks in a row now, we've avoided discussion about health-related issues. And I'm not doing that intentionally by any stretch. You start taking a look at some of the stuff we've got over here, and there are several of them that although I posted them God knows how many days ago, almost 10 days ago, it's been that long since I published anything on drkelly.info. There is a very interesting piece I would strongly guide you to. It's at the top of the page right now, called Index of Signs and Symptoms of Acute Poisoning. I strongly urge each and every one of you to read it. It's not lengthy. It's exactly two paragraphs long. And on the bottom of that front page piece, you don't even have to open up. It's right there on the front page. You will be able to download a PDF entitled The Index of Signs and Symptoms of Acute Poisoning. And this index will provide a table of pesticides and their related symptoms and signs and affected organ systems and poisoned individuals, which could be useful in raising the index of suspicion for pesticide toxicity where these signs and symptoms occur, because such suspicion could be evaluated further within the differential diagnosis as appropriate. But I share with you, it will be important to keep in mind that the signs and symptoms listed have multiple causes, pesticidal and non-pesticidal. In addition, no specific symptoms or signs are invariably present in poisonings by particular pesticides. Toxicological presentation may vary based on dosage, the routes of exposure, life stage of the patient's genetic vulnerability, co-exposures, and or underlying health status. And yet the complexity may explain why many poisonings are characterized by unexpected or atypical manifestations. And from that point, you'll be able to click on. You may not find it of interest, but you may want to get a copy of it to your doctor. Got several doctors that listen to our health programs. You may want to get them to them. A video we published from Dr. Vernon Coleman. He claims it's the most crucial videos ever made about COVID-19. Entitled, COVID-19 Vaccines Are Weapons of Mass Destruction. It could well wipe out the human race. Imperative to look at these things. I have contributed far more time to the issue of the COVID problem on Dr. Kelly. But it's the one thing that is in front of us constantly. COVID prevention, an alternative to vaccines, is another title we've got up there. Gene therapy poisoned of COVID vaccines by Dr. Judy Mikovits. Don't ignore it all. Get a look at it. Yeah, there's much going on. We'll be working on some stuff over the weekend. We're going to get some things brought up to date. I may work on some of this stuff tonight. I'm lagging. I don't like lagging. Beyond that, been an interesting week for us in sales. I'm not even pushing gold and silver, and people are calling buying it. That's pretty unique. Getting emails from people I haven't heard from in a long, 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 long time. We'll see what comes out of it. Crank the music, Bubba. Go with whatever we got, I guess. You guys have a good weekend. Oh, what a piece to close with, man. My brother Marvin. I'd never had it any other way. Take care of yourselves. Be good. Good night.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, brother. There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see. Sister, oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Right on. Right on.
Judge us simply cause our hands wrong.
Oh, you know that we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Pick it back and pick it sides. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can't see what's going on.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong part. Party and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.